Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Glad you could make it today. I'm Dan Proud, a member of Prairie, and I'm the default minister today. I always wanted to be a minister. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded community or congregation, and we welcome people of any ethnic and religious background, no matter your skin color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. And no matter what your age or abilities or inabilities. And later on in the service, we'll invite visitors and guests and returning friends to introduce yourselves so we can greet you. So on Sunday mornings, we offer a variety of services. We have a part-time minister, Sandy Ingham, who sometimes speaks, and sometimes it's Prairie members, as today, or other outside guests, guest speakers. So we'll start off with opening words by Robin Proud.
The opening words are brief. They're said by Angelica Schuyler in Hamilton. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And when I meet Thomas Jefferson, I'm going to compel him to put women in the sequel. So our chalice lighting is number 461. And I'll read the plain text and you can read the italics. We must be saved. Nothing worth doing is completed in our lifetime.
Therefore, we are saved by hope.
Nothing true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history.
Therefore, we are saved by faith.
Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone.
Therefore, we are saved by love.
No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as from our own.
Therefore, we are saved by the final form of love, which is your witness.
From Reinhold Niebuhr. Thank you.
Well, our speaker today is no stranger to most of you. My wife, Robin. What can I say about her that you don't know already? she has honed her public speaking skills, being involved with Toastmasters for several decades now. So if you have any thought of becoming a public speaker or a better, more confident speaker, talk to Robin. We have two children, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Louis, and we both met at Carleton College many years ago. That's our initial connection in the folk dance world. Robin has a special interest in historical figures, especially women, many of whom we've never heard of. So we're indebted to her for educating us on that. So please welcome Robin Proud.
I started talking about UU women quite a while ago, and I was mainly focusing on the 19th century. That was because one woman would tend to lead to another. They interacted or influenced each other. But I moved back in time. Now, that started partly because I read an excellent biography of Louisa Adams, John Quincy's wife, and I talked about that last year, how the political situation was not that different in those days from now. And I was influenced by my love of the Hamilton show. I started to read some more about that era. And also, Sandy has presented on some of these early figures, so we're piggybacking on each other. Now, sometimes when I prepare to talk on a historical subject, I wonder whether it's an appropriate topic at a moment when there's so much to discuss in current events. But history and current events are not separate. The discussion about statues of Confederate soldiers is a discussion about history and whose view of history will dominate. The Founding Fathers' wishes are often invoked, even for opposing viewpoints. When I was in school in the 1960s, history tended to show that everything about America was great, westward expansion, colonialism, it was all an arc toward the greatness of America. And history class was largely about memorizing dates and facts about presidents and wars, but history is full of people with virtues and flaws and messy situations. Some of you have heard me say that I consider myself a humanist and therefore a person of great faith. I say this because the history of humankind is often destructive. Yet somehow I still believe that humans can improve themselves and their world. I think that takes more faith than believing a supernatural force will arrive from somewhere to set things right. And I find it encouraging to learn about people in the past who faced challenges not unlike ours today and dealt with them. So today I'm going to speak about some of our founding mothers. We always hear about founding fathers. These were women who lived and wrote in the colonial and revolutionary periods in our country. And they were free thinkers in religious or political areas. Well, being in a new community in a new continent gave women some advantages. Early on, they were a prized minority, as there were many more men than women who had made the trek across the ocean. Although life was dangerous for everyone, women had the additional hazard of almost constant pregnancy and childbirth. Because they were a scarce commodity, women in the early colonial period could be choosy about who they married. They might demand a monetary settlement or a house before they would marry. Another advantage women had over their more civilized sisters in the old country was they had opportunities to fill non-traditional roles. Men were often away, hunting, sailing, exploring, fighting wars. There weren't extra men to take over the work at home, so women ran businesses and farms. Ben Franklin's wife, Deborah, helped run a group of print shops, a real estate portfolio, and even the postal service. Although he seemed to take all this for granted during her lifetime, after her death, he wrote, "I always discovered that she knew what I did not know, and if something escaped me, I could be certain that this was precisely what she had grasped." Abigail Adams took charge of the family farm and all financial matters for years at a time while her husband John was acting as a diplomat in Europe. Sometimes every available person was needed to deal with the necessities of making a life in uncharted areas. So women might have helped with outdoor work, for instance, that they wouldn't have done in Europe. And as a frontier society, the colonies had fewer established bodies to regulate private behavior. The authority they did have was the church. It has been said that the Puritans came to the New World for religious freedom, for themselves, and everyone else who believed exactly as they did. Sandy spoke not long ago about Anne Hutchinson, and she's the first one here. This obviously is some kind of reconstruction. I don't think anyone actually did a portrait of her. She had the radical idea that anyone could connect with God. She had the nerve to actually think about the Bible and what it said. So she thought that anyone could experience salvation. For this heresy, she was banished. She was called a woman not fit for our society. She protested, "I desire to know wherefore I am banished. That is, why is this happening?" Governor John Winthrop replied, "Say no more. The court knows wherefore and is satisfied." That is, we know why, that's all. You could say she got off easily, as she wasn't accused of witchcraft, an all too common way to get rid of obstreperous women. She did move to Rhode Island, later to New York, and actually, tragically, she and her children were killed by Indians at a later time. And I was mentioning this to my brother last night. He said that there was a television show in maybe the late 50s, early 60s, called Profiles in Courage, based on John F. Kennedy's book, but it expanded to other people. And he remembered that Anne Hutchinson was featured, which I'm very impressed that at that somewhat conservative time that they featured a woman who was outspoken in religious matters. In a similar vein, the poet Anne Bradstreet, so she was considered sometimes the first American poet, she questions how she could be sure that hers was the one true religion. She said, "How could I know whether there was a God? I never saw any miracles to confirm me. And those which I read of, how did I know but they were feigned?" Right? Maybe it was fake news, right? How could she know that just because she heard of a miracle? And then there was very much, of course, anti-Catholic sentiment. But she said, "May not the Popish religion be right? They have the same God, the same word. They interpret it one way, we another." As the revolution approached, women were active in the political sphere, organizing boycotts of British goods, refusing to drink tea or wear clothes from England. Women put their creativity to work, making tea from currant, raspberry, or sage leaves, and crafting garments from homespun material. A British officer remarked to Cornwallis, "We may destroy all the men in America, and we still shall have all we can do to defeat the women." Mercy Otis Warren is over here.
Name again?
Oh, her name is Mercy Otis Warren. Her brother was James Otis, who was active against the Stamp Act. And she herself was a historian, poet, and essayist. She was known for her satirical attacks on the British and their loyalist allies. She eventually wrote a 3-volume eyewitness history of the Revolution. Some credit her with helping organize the committees of correspondence, which were the first gatherings of representatives from the various colonies before any kind of constitutional convention. Although we wouldn't exactly call her a feminist, Mercy Warren, like Abigail Adams and the others I'm going to talk about, recognized the defects in women's education. She wrote, "I believe it will be found that the deficiency lies not so much in the inferior contexture of the female intellect as in a different education bestowed on the sexes. That is, women do not have a lesser intellect, but they do not get the same education. When these temporary distinctions subside, we may be equally qualified to taste the full draft of knowledge and happiness prepared for the upright of every nation and sex." Women not only took on many roles while their menfolk were off fighting the revolution, but many of them went along. This happened in Europe at the time as well. There were many camp followers, and these were generally not prostitutes, as you might think. They were wives, laundresses, and cooks. The army paid them and provided some rations. Martha Washington was with her husband for most of the war. She had some incentives for this. The loyalist governor of Virginia apparently tried to capture her as a hostage at one time, and the press claimed that she was a secret loyalist herself, who was deliberately living apart from her husband. So she took a journey north to join George, who was in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time, and it was a publicity event. Along the way, she met with patriot groups. Then she stayed with George in Philadelphia, New York, New Jersey, and she was even there in Valley Forge. She made trips back to Mount Vernon to collect supplies. There really was no supply organization. There was no real government. Martha was not a young woman. She was 43 when the revolution started. Of course, the other stalwart wife of the time was Abigail Adams, and I've decided she deserves a program of her own, so I look forward to that. After the war, the leaders of the new country were very conscious that they were conducting an unprecedented experiment. With no king, the people would govern. How would they learn to become citizens and take on their responsibilities? The only models were classical. They looked to the ancient Greek city-states. And the new society took very seriously the values of citizenship. Included in that was the role of women as the mothers who would educate future citizens. So John Adams famously treated Abigail's request to remember the ladies as a joke, but he also wrote, "It is by the female world that the greatest and best characters among men are formed." Those with some money could now send their girls to female or co-educational academies. It's at this point that Judith Sargent Murray came onto the public scene. With all my research, Judith was new to me this year. Yet I've known about her husband for some time, so that's John Murray. Now, it may be that she's becoming a bit more known because recently she's been being rediscovered. She kept letter books, which means she kept a copy of every letter she wrote. This is very valuable. Scholar Bonnie Hurd Smith is still in the process of transcribing and annotating these letters. Now, in my over 25 years of teaching Unitarian Universalist Sunday School, I've learned the story of John Murray's arrival in the New World, so I'm going to give you the children's version. I don't know whether Jesse might remember that. You're the only one that's probably been here long enough to have heard this. This is right off of one of the UU sites or one of the UU curricula. You never know what the wind will blow in or which way the wind blows. The wind can change directions or maybe change your life. It happened to John Murray. As a young man in England, John Murray had excellent fortune blow his way. He had a fine education, a steady job, a loving wife, and a young son. Life was good. But suddenly everything changed. John Murray's wife and their son became sick and died. John lost his job, lost all his money, and was put in jail because he could not pay his bills. John was a very religious man, a universalist, who had even preached about a loving God. Now he was not so sure what he believed. He felt his life was over. Friends urged him to go someplace where he could start again. He sailed for America on a ship named the Hand in Hand. The wind blew the ship toward their destination, New York, but then fog rolled in and the ship ran aground in New Jersey instead. John and a few others volunteered to leave the ship, go on land, and get directions and supplies. As he was walking ashore, John saw a farmhouse with a small chapel beside it. It belonged to a man named Thomas Potter. Thomas Potter greeted John, gave him food for the people on the ship, and invited John to come back and have dinner with him that night. When John came back, Thomas Potter showed him the chapel. He said that he believed in a loving God who wanted to accept all people into heaven. Well, John said he believed the same thing. Thomas Potter told John he had built the chapel and was waiting for God to send him a minister. You, John, are that minister. I have waited for you a long time. John did not want to hear this. He was not a preacher anymore, and he was determined to never preach again. Yet Thomas Potter seemed confident that John was the universalist preacher he waited for, and he asked John to preach on Sunday. I can't preach on Sunday, said John, because as soon as the wind changes, my boat will set sail and I must be on it. If the boat has not sailed by Sunday, will you preach? Asked Thomas Potter. If I'm still here on Sunday, I will preach, said John Murray. No wind blew. No ship sailed. John Murray preached on Sunday morning, September 30th, 1770, in the chapel Thomas Potter had built many years before. The Universalist message of the power of love was good news to many who heard. It was good news for John. The winds of change blew yet again for John Murray. He now wanted to preach more than anything, and he did for many years and helped found Universalism in America. He's one of the ancestors of our faith home, and we as Unitarian Universalists owe a special thanks to Thomas Potter. It was his hospitality that brought John Murray back to the pulpit. We also owe a special thanks to the wind that blew him in and would not blow him out. Since our Unitarian myth, I'm a little disturbed by how mythologized this is and how miraculous this is depicted. Now, when I used to have Jesse and the others in class, when we had some of these stories, I'd say, well, we do not have any video of what actually happened at the time. So this is the story. But John Murray is often featured in our Unitarian curricula, Universalist curricula as well. A side note is that it's through a woman that John Murray became a Universalist in the first place. He started out in England as a Calvinist preacher. He heard that a young woman in his area had joined the congregation of a heretic, George Relly. Relly reasoned that Christ had died for everyone, therefore everyone was saved, not just a select few. Murray called on this woman to disabuse her of her error, but she debated him with so convincingly that he ended up joining the new church himself. Now, Judith Sargent came from a family of some means. She read and wrote from an early age. In 1769, at the age of 18, She married not John Murray, but a man named John Stevens, the son of a prominent shipping family. The following year, her whole family learned about Universalism and invited Murray to Gloucester, Massachusetts. So I don't know, Orange, if you have any pictures from that church, but afterwards maybe you would like to show those. So that's delightful that you happened to be there, because this was one of the first Universalist churches, obviously, in the country. It probably was the first after this tiny chapel that is probably no longer there. Judith and her husband had no children, but she raised two nieces, and as a result, she began to teach other children in the new church, and she actually published a catechism or children's lessons about Universalism. In 1784, Judith published her first essay, which included the following: "I would, from the early dawn of reason, address my daughter as a rational being, and by all means guard daughters against a low estimation of themselves." Unfortunately, the shipping business operated by Judith's husband was wiped out by the war. To avoid debt, he escaped in 1786 to the West Indies, where he tried to set up a new business, but he died soon after his arrival. 2 years later, John Murray, still a widower because his wife had died back in England, wrote to Judith that he had long loved her. So he had been a friend of their family since they invited him to Gloucester. They married. They had a son who lived only a few hours. 2 years later, at age 40, Judith bore her only surviving child, Julia Maria Murray. Around this time, she also brought into the world an essay called On the Equality of the Sexes. Like other essayists of the time, she used a Latin pen name. She called herself Constantia, or Constance. And here are a few excerpts. She said, "Are we, that is, women, are we deficient in reason? We can only reason from what we know. And if opportunity of acquiring knowledge hath been denied us, the inferiority of our sex cannot fairly be deduced from thence." That is the same thing. How can we be blamed if we were never given education? And talking about the supposed superiority of the male, it may be questioned, from what does this superiority proceed? May we not trace its source in the difference of education and continued advantages? Will it be said that the judgment of a male of 2 years old is more sage than that of a female of the same age? I believe the reverse is generally observed to be true. But from that period, what partiality? How is one exalted and the other depressed by the contrary modes of education which are adopted? The one is taught to aspire, and the other is early confined and limited. As their years increase, the sister must be wholly domesticated, while the brother is led by the hand through all the flowery paths of science. She experiences a mortifying consciousness of inferiority, which embitters every enjoyment. Now, was she permitted the same instructors as her brother for the employment of a rational mind? An ample field would be opened. I would ask, is it reasonable that an intelligent being should at present be so degraded as to be allowed no other ideas than those which are suggested by the mechanism of a pudding or the sewing of the seams of a garment? Yes, ye lordly, ye haughty sex, that is men, our souls are by nature equal to yours. The same breath of God animates, enlivens, and invigorates us. So Judith wrote this in 1779 during her first marriage, although she didn't publish it until later. This was well before Mary Wollstonecraft's famous Vindication of the Rights of Women in 1792 and Margaret Fuller's Woman in the 19th Century, which was still shocking in 1845. Judith's husband, John Murray, supported her writing and beliefs, and she joined him in spreading Universalism in the new country. Hers was a voice of inspiration to the infant republic. With Judith Sargent Murray, I finally found a woman who could be a public figure with radical ideas and a supportive partner. So some of the women I've studied just remained single: the astronomer Mariah Mitchell and the sociologist Harriet Martineau. Both expressed how pleased they were with their single status. Margaret Fuller married very late in life to a younger man who was not at all her intellectual equal. Julia Ward Howe went from a controlling father to a controlling husband. He despised her desire to speak and write in public. You may remember that the day after her husband died, Julia Ward Howe wrote in her journal, "My new life begins today." And her husband was a wonderful person in a way that he had an academy that taught deaf and blind students. He taught Laura Perkins, who was a forerunner of Helen Keller. But he had ideas about what wives should do and not do. Lydia Maria Child, the abolitionist, found a husband who shared her activism. He also believed in abolition and women's rights, but he kept throwing money into far-fetched schemes so that they were always poor, and eventually she had to transfer her money from him to another man because even in the second half of the 19th century, a woman could not control her own finances. So that was not the best relationship either. Even in the time of great upheaval and reinvention that the American Revolution represented, Judith was way ahead of her time. And the fact that she found a husband who supported her seems to me a greater miracle than the wind, which supposedly kept John Murray on shore to preach the first Universalist sermon in America. Yeah, right, we don't have to go back far in history. It's just that the common knowledge or common expectation about what women could do or say was even more restricted in these times, and yet, as we saw in this, she persisted still into, certainly well into modern times. That's really delightful, and like I said, maybe I'll send something to Prairie Fire about a couple of these books that I used. Yeah. And we have new fronts in this struggle, like whole tech community issues and online issues. And the flip side is, I don't know if anyone's brave enough to admit this, but there are some men who have no interest or talent in mechanical things, and you're supposed to pretend that you do, right? There's a quote from Margaret Fuller, which is one of our readings in the back of our book, but talking about how that equality would be better for everybody. And at the same time, we have certain backlash that is occurring, or has always been occurring at different periods. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. And our closing words actually are not by John Murray. I'm not sure why I thought that they do seem to embody what I think he might have said. Amazingly, there is nothing from John Murray in this hymnal. The Universalists are being overlooked again. And this talks about God, which you could interpret as you like, but I think this is the kind of spirit that a number of our folks here on the board would have supported. Go out into the highways and byways. Give the people something of your new vision. You may possess a small light, but uncover it. Let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach the kindness and everlasting love of God. That's from Alfred S. Cole, who apparently is a Unitarian minister. So do greet your neighbor, regardless of mama, and join us for coffee.